Morning is number 120194, Allen versus Coil Tubing.
May it please the court?
Yes, sir.
For a company to deny oil-filled workers overtime pay by claiming an exemption under the Motor Carrier Act exemption, it must prove that each of the workers drives interstate or has a reasonable expectation of doing so. When the company has multiple dispatching districts in different states, should that reasonable expectation be determined on an individual basis, a district basis, or a company-wide basis? In other words, should the driving statistics from Wyoming create a reasonable expectation for a worker who's dispatched out of Alice, Texas?
Well, suppose they decided to change their business model and moved all their dispatch services to Houston. You wouldn't even have an argument, would you?
Well, yes, ma'am, because Houston's instructions may be to dispatch the local trucks out of Wyoming, for example. So the rule in Houston, if we have a central dispatch for the entire company, would be to go to the district where the trucks are closest by. The evidence we've developed has shown that the districts are sort of profit centers. It would not make sense to the district to send its truck to Wyoming.
I'm saying suppose they just didn't want to, I don't know what amount of damages you're claiming or whatever, but they just didn't like to face another Fair Labor Standards Act case, and so they moved all of the dispatching to Houston.
Yes, ma'am. If they dispatched everybody out of Houston, but if their policy were to dispatch workers to jobs around Alice from Alice, then we'd be in the exact same situation we are here.
Let me ask you what must be a really dumb question here. But as I understand what I've read, the DOT says that this test rests on the possibility that the drivers may actually cross state lines. And of course, that's contrary to all the rest of our interstate commerce jurisprudence. You can drive on Interstate 10 from my house to the grocery store, and that's in interstate commerce. So why is that not the case with regard to this regulation?
Yes, ma'am. Actually, there is the initial regulation about whether the employer is involved in interstate commerce.
Right.
And that is determined on the broader standard of what interstate commerce is. But when it comes to whether the employee drives across straight lines or has a reasonable expectation of doing so, that's done on the narrower category of either did he actually drive across state lines or did he transport materials that are in the practical continuity of movement.
And is that in a statute or a regulation or what?
I'm sure that's from the regulation because it comes from the regulations that establish the reasonable expectation test. Probably more significant than that, at least the other courts seem to place great weight on it, is in 1981, the Department of Transportation issued a notice letter that says just that, that he has to have driven interstate or have a reasonable expectation of doing so. That's a really critical notice letter because it also points out
that... Is that the regulation in which they cited the Douglas?
Pardon me, sir?
Is that the regulation in which they cited the Douglas case?
I don't know that case, Your Honor, to respond to that question properly. The Douglas case? Maybe I'm knowing the other side of the...
I thought there was a Seventh Circuit Douglas case that the department just...
The Goldberg case?
Pardon?
Is that the Goldberg case, Your Honor?
Maybe I've got the name mixed up.
In the Goldberg, well, they are referring to that same inversely all of these cases. It's the 37902,
yeah.
46 FR 37902.
In the Goldberg case,
yes, Your Honor.
More or less has this rationale in it, huh?
Yes, Your Honor. The rationale is that, for example, I think if I'm on the same case as Your Honor, that there were the 20 workers, five of whom had dedicated, or five of whom traveled interstate, and 15 of them had dedicated intrastate routes. And the holding there was that those with the dedicated intrastate routes, even though they're drivers and their colleagues are drivers, were nevertheless not exempt.
But dedicated is the critical word, isn't it?
Yes, because they had no reasonable expectation of driving interstate. They weren't commingled with the other workers as they were in the Morris case.
Right, but, well, and in the, that's a Second Circuit case, 1961, correct?
Yes.
And it does talk about Morris. And in the paragraph about Morris, it says, if the facts were like Morris, where they might still cross interstate lines, then we wouldn't come out with the outcome. And I thought that Judge Atlas here made an explicit finding, it's the text accompanying her footnote 29, that any one of these FSEs, quote, were or could have been called upon to drive interstate commerce at any time.
She did make that conclusion, Your Honor.
So you have to establish that's clear error in order to win under Goldberg.
Well, actually, what we're asking, Your Honor, is not to make a ruling on the underlying case. The focus of this interlocutory appeal is on methodology. And so Her Honor reached that conclusion because she applied a different methodology. We think the wrong methodology, a methodology used nowhere in the country.
But it's still a factual finding, isn't it?
Well, she made that factual finding based on what, on a percentage that comes from accumulating the statistics from Wyoming and Alice.
I don't read the record that way because the legal question before us that is up on interlocutory is based, did she interpret the NCA correctly? And we've got controlling precedent, Songer, on that.
Correct.
She said over and over again, I'm trying to decipher what the Fifth Circuit meant in Songer. And then when she goes through it, I think before she gets to this district-to-district or corporate-wide question, which is what I thought was before us, now it's morphed a little bit into, well, did she put each individual plaintiff into the group before she did extrapolate? But when I go through the record closely, the first thing she says is the field engineers are out, the service coordinators are out, even individual plaintiff Broussard, because of his criminal record, he's out. And then she says the ones that are left, I make the Morris finding, the Goldberg finding, that any of them could have reasonably expected. That's doing it. I see that as exactly what Songer's told her to do, and I don't see why it's wrong.
The difference is very simply that Songer and Morris, apply, and for that matter Barefoot, had only one dispatching district. And so when she was trying to come up with the likelihood that somebody might drive an interstate job, Judge Atlas, in her second opinion, the one that's being appealed here,
okay,
accumulated the statistics from the entire company. So we would never have gotten beyond the 3% or 4% threshold that we see in Morris as well as in Songer.
Had she gone district by district.
But
then, so that is the question of law. This isn't an issue of whether she properly put individual plaintiffs in the group. The issue is, do we subdivide a company that is the single employer with one DOT number into its subcomponents, corporate structure, geographically? That's the issue before us.
Well,
right?
I would resist the idea of subdividing the company, but your the heart of where your question is going is correct.
Okay.
Does a worker in Alice, Texas have any reasonable expectation of driving interstate based on the high number of interstate trips that workers dispatched out of Wyoming have?
And again, but you will, maybe you can, if you don't know the answer off the top of your head, maybe you can give me a 28J letter about why the use of interstate highway isn't sufficient to make that a possible. At one time, the DOT, the ICC regulated interstate carriage, the states regulated intrastate carriage, and then there were certain other, my father-in-law was in the trucking business, so this must have something to do with that.
Yes.
Change in jurisdictions.
Yes, ma'am, and actually I was not aware of that until some of the citations in the regs themselves in the 782 series go into how we got to a different standard for interstate commerce for both of those.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to dwell on it.
I think your strongest argument is that the Department of Transportation regulations, which are based in part upon that I keep miscalling the name of the case, do anticipate something like she started off to do district by district, and then she had changed. And I couldn't find any reason that she explained why she was changing, except she might have thought that our case, Songer, required it. But Songer is really inapposite, because it doesn't even set up a situation where you might apply those regulations the way the department seems to anticipate.
Yes, Your Honor. And I wondered in the Songer case if we were able to try to understand that opinion in broader context. What if the company in Songer had a plant or a dispatching district in Midland, Texas, 100% of whose workers drove intrastate? What would happen to the four workers who were working in Midland as opposed to the four workers who worked in the actual location for Songer? Would they have been held to have an expectation of driving interstate? I think not.
But didn't she do that? I mean, that's just like saying, what if they had a district, I think maybe it was your hypothetical in a brief or opposing counsel's, what if one of their districts is Hawaii,
yes,
where they can't drive?
Correct.
Well, wouldn't she have just done exactly what she did here, which is, well, that's like Plaintiff Broussard. He can't cross state lines. He's not in the group.
The only way you get to understanding that Plaintiff Broussard is different, and there are actually others who were prohibited by company regulation from driving who did not have a CDL such as Cody Patan, is to perform an individual analysis and ask what's going on with that gentleman.
But then that's what the statute requires.
That's
any employee, you agree.
But I agree.
I guess the Songer test may not be the most beautiful one, but I don't see where Judge Atlas made any mistake. She did exactly what the statute said. Any employee, reasonable expectation to drive motor vehicles that affect interstate commerce.
But don't we have to give some deference to what the department has said?
Yes, Your Honor.
That this law means?
Yes.
I mean, it's got to be arbitrary in some respects.
Well,
crossing state lines, as Chief Judge points out, but they've chosen that test, and they more or less chosen a 4% or something like that. That's awful arbitrary. And if you're going to interpret it, the department has interpreted it. And I don't think that Judge Atlas is following that interpretation. And the court should give much more deference, because you're cutting off people from wage and hour laws. You're cutting off people from FSLA. If we're going to, you know, do anything, if the courts have any leeway here, we should not go back to a situation and just say, well, this case is like Songer. It's not like Songer. It's quite different.
Yes, Your Honor. We're not asking for Songer to be overruled. I believe that Songer perfectly follows Morris. It simply doesn't apply to this situation because it had only one dispatching district. So the statistics in Songer were company-wide were also district-wide. They were coterminous. That is not true in a case like this. It's not true in a case like CentOS, where you have a national company and each location would be treated separately. It's not true in a case like Kimball versus Goodyear, where you have an international company. They looked at the workers' statistics from that particular location. And so we do have precedent for looking at the different locations. No one wants to subdivide a company. I was accused of that below. I'm not trying to say that this is not one company. I'm simply saying that this company has operations that, because of the way it's chosen to run its business.
Well, let me ask you a question. What period of time are you considering this? I mean, you say it's chosen. Alice, Texas was a blip on the map until 7 or 8 years ago when fracking, you know, became a big deal. So, what span of time are you just saying this? So basically, whether these employees are going to be walking in and out of coverage depending on the vicissitudes of the oil market, just as they walk out of coverage from being longshoremen to seamen and so on, right?
There are plenty of cases which describe that the employee may come in and then go out of coverage, which under the 40-day rule, the four-month rule, it would make no sense if every worker who could be called a driver therefore assumes the driving statistics and expectations
of
people elsewhere.
A driver or a person who is loading and all that.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And back with respect to Alice, you were asking how long would we go back. In this case, I'm not sure that you have to ask that question, because the workers themselves were there with long enough tenure so that their own experience can be evaluated.
My difficulty, and it really may just be factual, but I think it is legal also, is I don't see how any of this discussion about districts is relevant if she makes the factual finding that no matter what district you worked in, you could expect at any time to go to any district and drive.
But she could only make that by following her interpretation of Morris and Songer and Barefoot, for that matter, that said that you look at the statistics, and those courts simply did not address the statistics in a company that had different dispatching districts. So she had really no evidence to say that there was a 7% likelihood of an Alice worker driving interstate when, in fact, her prior ruling said the opposite of that. She made a factual finding in the prior ruling, and the statistics in Alice were...
So is your basic, correct me if I'm wrong, your position legally to us is basically reinstate her first ruling. You want us to reinstate her original ruling.
No. Well,
am I wrong?
No, they want individual.
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
But we've just gone through how there's everything she did was individual. She carved out the field engineers, the service coordinator. She carves out Broussard. And then she even says the ones that I have in this group. So I can't see that there's an individual mistake.
She did because she didn't address, for example, Cody Patan, who by company rule was prohibited from driving trucks during the entire relevant time frame.
Well, that's foreclosed by Songer because the issue isn't what they were relevant time frame. It's reasonable expectation as to future work.
Well, but the only time frame she was rendering her judgment on was the time frame in which he was prohibited from driving.
You have your red light on.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, my fault.
That's okay. Mr. Moore.
May it please the court. Good morning. To respond to a few of the things that that Mr. Jackson argued, first of all, nowhere in the regulations is there a requirement for the application of the motor carrier exemption that a company maintain a central dispatching location. That appears nowhere. That's a theory that they've concocted to try to avoid the application of Songer in this case. I think Your Honor also recognized that when someone has a dedicated intrastate route, there is no reasonable expectation. And that case that they're relying on is insufficient under these circumstances to demonstrate that the MCA exemption does not apply.
Which case are you talking about?
It was the one that was discussed. It was either Goldfarb or the 1961 case.
I think
that,
it's the same thing.
That brought
up Goldberg.
I think there were some dedicated interstate routes, and the other employees were not expected to go out of state.
Which is exactly...
So I think you're misinterpreting that case as being in your favor. I think it argues against you.
Well, I would disagree with that only because in this particular instance, the drivers don't have any dedicated routes. They go wherever the work is. The record supports that conclusion. They go from district to district. They go across state lines, and they're expected to do that. The people who have dedicated...
When you say the record supports it, to me that's absolutely core crucial. What's your best record site for that?
The best record site for that is the affidavits of the district managers in this particular case, which are Ed Birchfield, Ray Reyna, and several others. I'd be happy to present a letter with a specific site, which is in our
well,
briefing.
The only time Judge Atlas talked in detail about that was in her first opinion, wasn't it? And she went the other way.
Talked in detail about what, Your Honor?
About whether any of these employees were willy-nilly assigned all over the map instead of mostly within certain districts.
I think she addressed that.
She divided everything into districts, did she not, in the first
opinion? In the first opinion, which she decided she had not properly analyzed because of Songer and other factors, she did break the company into pieces and analyze it that way, which we argued was an inappropriate action to view the company, which is one entity.
But she didn't overrule her specific finding that in most instances the workers in question were not assigned outside those districts. And I don't know how she got from her first analysis to her second analysis.
Well, I'm not sure she made a finding that most workers did not do what you mentioned. But I think
I read that in her opinion.
The travel does show that there are occasional trips across state lines. I shouldn't use the word occasional. There was one in each quarter during the relevant period we're talking about here, which the DOT measures this into 4 months. When you have an interstate trip, people in that group are exempt for 4 months, and that's the point of her second ruling, is that A, she shouldn't have broken the company down into pieces when it's a single entity. The action is each and every one of these people is employed by this single entity, and there's no basis.
Well, you're not contesting the fact that if the company is naturally its work falls naturally into divisions, like she apparently thought in her first opinion, that the law would require that you look at them that way and not mix them all together like she did ultimately.
I would contest that. I think her second effort at this was the right way to look at this, which is
That's not my question. My question is, if you had a company where it was absolutely clear that it was broken into districts and that there was no crossover, wouldn't the regulations of the Department of Transportation, which builds upon Goldberg and the other cases, wouldn't it require looking at these districts separately, the way she did the first time?
I might agree under the certain qualifications you've given on that, but that's not the case here.
Well, that was the purpose of my question.
The case here
is... we can get together on something.
You can break up a company in a lot of ways. You can say, hey, wait, they've got a little portion of their project in Hawaii. And you would agree if those people couldn't cross state lines, they would never get into the group, right?
I don't agree with that.
You don't.
Let me tell you why.
Okay.
Because there are two different ways that one can engage in interstate commerce. One is to actually carry an employer's property across a state line. That's the first way. The second way is to engage in the practical continuity of movement in interstate commerce, which is, for instance, milk transporters, as in Barefoot. They're engaged in the practical continuity because they're taking milk from farm to processing, and then that goes out of state.
Did Judge Atlas base anything on a continuity of a product being taken somewhere?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
She did not. But to answer his question, I thought I needed to point out there were
But
two
she
different
did
ways.
Divide geographically. She said offshore people, no. Onshore, yes.
That's correct.
So she, and then field engineers, no. Field service engineers, yes. So she totally did understand that you would break a company down by whether the people affected interstate commerce. She just didn't do it according to some corporate organizational structure, or she didn't try to do it in terms of time. At this point, fracking here, lots of driving, this point not. She didn't do it in the way some people are urging, but she did do it according to Songer.
Agreed, and I would add to that that what she did was break it down into a group or class of employees that performs safety-affecting duties in interstate transportation, which is the only test that matters in this case. And the way she broke that down was to take the equipment operators, the service technician ones, the service technician twos, the service supervisors, the guys who are driving this 180,000-pound oil field equipment across our highways out to the oil field to work, and then coming back. She broke it into those people. And there's only two tests that have to be met in order for the exemption to apply. The first one is CTS a motor carrier?
That's not disputed.
Not disputed. Is CTS an interstate motor carrier? Also not disputed. The second question is, does the group of employees over whom the exemption is attempting to be asserted perform safety-affecting activities in interstate?
And the challenge for you there is, why do you choose the word group? Doesn't the statute say, does the individual?
It does. It does not. The statute says that the exemption does not apply to an individual over whom the Secretary of Transportation has the power to regulate qualifications and hours of service. That's what it says. But the regulations...
And we have to decide that according to that department's regulations.
Actually, the DOL promulgates regulations on the application of the exemption itself. The DOT defines things like what are the hours of service, what drug testing is required.
I gathered that all of these employees were basically qualified, the ones we're talking about, as if they were drivers, the ones who have the commercial driver's license, and they keep, it looked to me as if they were, unless this was all a ruse to evade the Fair Labor Standards Act, they were all qualified for DOT purposes.
There are a couple of grains of sand on the beach that have been pointed out, but those have been carved out as
well, that's
your
what
colleague.
I'm saying. Generally speaking, the company treated them as if they were all under the DOT regulation, which includes maximum hours of service.
Absolutely. And one thing to understand here is the company was not attempting to, and is not attempting to, assert the Motor Carrier Act exemption over, let's say, secretaries or clerical people who have no effect on safety. It's only the people who take these giant vehicles out into the field with multi-ton equipment attached to the back of it and do the work of the company. Those are the only people here that the Motor Carrier Act exemption is attempting to be asserted. Now, to get back to your question about why am I using the word group or class, that's what the regulations say.
The regulation uses the word class.
The DOL's regulations defining the scope of the Motor Carrier Act exemption use, if the employer belongs to a class of employers, right. And the employee does
and
a class.
And we use that word in Songer.
Yes.
Okay.
Does the employee do a class of work?
Neither side opposed the bellwether approach, right? To that extent, it couldn't be individualized because both sides agreed to take a representative group subset. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I want to point out in Songer was not a collective action where there was a sort of a class representative presented. That was actually, Judge McBride actually denied class certification in that case. And I'll point out some of the statistics we were talking about in Songer and the underlying decision. Only 8 of 25 of the drivers actually engaged in the interstate driving. And 21 of 25 engaged in the practical continuity of movement and or the interstate driving. But that brings me to one of the points I want to make here, and that is that Congress, when they were developing this statute, this was the first exemption that was enacted, and what it was a governmental balancing of interests. One is, do we have the right to be safe on our public highways versus does this individual have a right to get extra pay for working more than 40 hours in a week? And they chose public safety over extra compensation. And why did they choose that?
And that was in, what, 1935 or?
So, yes, Your Honor, it was either 35 or 38. I'm not quite
so
sure.
So they weren't thinking about superhighways and big trucks on superhighways back then, were they?
Which I think would only enhance the potential danger of a 180,000-pound truck traveling at 75 to 80 miles an hour is inherently more unsafe than one driving on a two-lane road at 35 or 40.
Once you're exempt, it isn't just you lose overtime. Employees suffer, right? You're under a whole separate category, and they have other benefits and costs, and it's not really for us to say, well, one's bad for them or one's good. That's not the analysis here.
That isn't, and I would point out that the employer chooses to comply with DOT regulations in this particular instance. They ask their employees to do these things that protect public safety, like fill out driver's logs to limit the number of hours that they work. And other things that, you know, inspect these vehicles, repair them when necessary. Those things are choices made by the employer that aren't without cost. And public safety in this particular instance was elevated over the right of a worker to receive overtime.
Is the MCA exception coextensive with the DOT regulation? I mean, we seem to be proceeding on the assumption here that it is not necessarily, that the scope of the exception can be narrower than the scope of the DOT regulation of the drivers. And I just wondered about that.
I'm not totally clear on the question, but I think the DOL's definition of, are you getting back to the interstate commerce issue?
No. Just the, do the regulated... Maybe it's a stupid, another dumb question.
No, I
do
just...
Their whole argument is premised on the idea that even though these people may be regulated by DOT for purposes of safety, nevertheless, they are not within the MCA exception. And I was just asking if that is if you can arbitrarily carve out people who are legitimately within DOT regulation from the MCA exception?
No. If you are subject to DOT regulation because you're performing a safety-affecting duty, then you are subject to DOT regulation and not subject to the DOL's, or excuse me, the statute concerning overtime and the DOL's.
So the flip side of that is, if these employees are not subject, as the plaintiffs claim, on an individual basis to the Fair Labor to the MCA exception, and they're all covered by FLSA, then the company could withdraw them from the DOT regulations.
Certainly.
It might not want to, but it could.
Certainly.
Okay.
And all that's required for that is to start paying overtime in hours in excess of 40.
Right, but that would also then have a lesser amount of safety and security attached to the transportation that they're involved in.
That's correct. And in this case, the company decided that its safety obligations per DOT regulations outweighed they chose that path over simply ignoring the DOT's safety regulations and paying overtime in this situation.
So the only real effect would be that they all of them could conceivably drive more than 40 hours a week or something like that, and be paid overtime instead of being restricted to 40 hours under the DOT.
Well, DOT restricts to 70 working hours, okay. And there's certain numbers of driving hours that you're allowed to have there. But but you raise a good point, and that is, in this case, the DOT has actually exercised authority over these very types of workers. There's specific language in 49 CFR 395 where there is an oil field exception to the hours of service regulation, and that is that when you're on the well site waiting to work, you don't count that against your 70 hours. So not only are we in the theoretical sense regulated by DOT because of the interstate activity of this company, we're in the actual. That regulation actually, by DOT, actually regulates what these individuals have to record on their logs when they're working out at a well site. Now, a couple of other things that I heard come up during the other argument was the mere authority to regulate is all that matters, and that's accurate. It's not, as I just pointed out, even if they didn't articulate the specific regulation allowing people to not count as work time while they're waiting, we would still be in the realm of the possibility. Back to Songer, what's interesting and what I don't think anyone's addressed either by question or by statement today is that there were four people there who never did anything that affected interstate commerce. They were drivers, but they never did anything. And those people were held in Songer to be exempt. And the reason they were held to be exempt is because Songer teaches that you look at this group of people. If they belong to the class of employees that could reasonably be expected to affect safety in their duties in interstate transportation, then they are exempt, even though they've never done anything interstate.
Label. It isn't just because the company decides to call people something, right?
I missed the first part of your statement.
Four in Songer, though they didn't cross state lines, were still included. It isn't just because the company can say, and I'm going to call you a driver, right? The district court's got to go through searchingly and say, this individual could have been called anywhere to drive and had the same duties, right?
What they have to look at is, does he belong to the group of people?
But that has to be a very probing analysis about activities, functions, and expectations.
I'm not sure how probing it has to be,
she did it with Broussard here again.
Well,
she looked
yes.
enough to look behind the label of his job title and say, but I find he can't affect the commerce.
That's correct.
Okay.
And in speaking in general terms, which is what she did here, the exemption applies when you have, my point that I'm trying to make is, when you have an individual who never does the interstate transportation that's exempt, then it's absurd to have to look at their individual activity. There's no need for that when you have somebody who isn't doing the activity that they claim we have to prove in every case that's exempt due to Songer and due to the regulations, then it precludes what the plaintiffs or appellants would want here, which is a bottom-up analysis of basically work week by work week, what did this individual do? The only thing that matters per Songer and per the regulations is, do they perform a class of work that affects safety and interstate transportation? And that's what the judge found, that these individuals do indeed do that, and the fact that some of them might not is irrelevant as per Songer.
Well, Songer says it's not what do you do, it's what could you do.
Correct, and that is the law.
Yes.
It's not what did you do, it's what could you do, which renders individual analysis inappropriate. The analysis has to be top-down.
Technically, it's not what you could do, it's what you could reasonably be called upon to be doing.
I think that's probably correct, yeah. that the reasonable expectation that the employer has about your duties. Now, there's five things I want to close with here, if there aren't any other questions. They're quick. There's five principles that show that Judge Atlas properly applied Songer. First, it's the mere power that matters to the DOT. It's not whether they exercise. Here we have actual exercise.
You're just summarizing what you've said, right?
Not all the way.
Well, then say it. All right. You haven't said, say.
The another principle, drivers always affect transportation safety. Another factor, proportion of driving versus other duties is irrelevant. So I'll close with that, unless there are further questions.
No, sir. Thank you.
Very briefly, I'll mention that this idea that it's a top-down and it does not matter what the driver does is exactly opposite of what the Department of Transportation has said. It said, this is a direct quote, the activities or likely activities of the individual driver must be reviewed. That's the Department of Transportation's opinion. Also, the Songer opinion, which we've been discussing today and is relevant law in this case, but it just doesn't address the situation of the multiple districts, noted that all of the drivers had driving duties only, full duty drivers. Here we have vast amounts of other work. For example, Adam Cruz, 195 days offshore, could not affect interstate commerce while doing so. Harold Sparks, 327 days offshore, could not affect it. In addition to Cody Patan, Donald Woodard, precluded from driving a company truck by the company because he didn't have a CDL.
Well, what about his point that in Songer there were four people that couldn't have affected and they're included?
They could have affected, and they were included because the statistics show there was a reasonable expectation. They had a greater than 3% likely, or about a 3% likelihood, which that court interpreted in conformity with Morris.
I'm oversimplifying, but I don't see how you get around her very explicit factual finding that in every district, people with this title had to expect, could at any time.
They only could expect that, Your Honor, because she was basing that on the company-wide statistics of 7%. So that's why I come back to this question. This appeal is about methodology. We're asking Your Honors to instruct her on the methodology because she ended up with that conclusion based on changed methodology.
May I ask you to answer the question that I asked him? Because if these employees are all legitimately within the DOT regulation because they are class of affect transportation and interstate commerce, and frankly, I drive a lot on I-10 and I would not want to be behind one of these things when it failed, but if they are legitimately, how can you say that the MCA exception is not coextensive with that regulation?
The MCA is coextensive, but the if is the problem. When they're driving intrastate, it is plain that they are not under DOT regulation. Now, the company can voluntarily ask its employees to fill out DOT forms to keep time, and that's exactly what happened here.
So you're saying that either they're wasting their money on employees complying with regulations, I presume that means they have to file reports to the DOT and so on, complying with those regulations, or even though they have to comply with those, they do not get the benefit of the MCA.
There are two different things. One is the company is going to be an interstate motor carrier. We know that. Nobody's contesting that. And they're going to have certain compliance because of that. Number two, whether they're wasting money is highly problematic. They're probably saving a great deal of money. The things that they're requiring from the employees to fill out, for example, DOT timesheets, is not costing this company money. In addition to that, for intrastate driving, there are massive regulations in the state of Texas that are going to protect motorists and require certain reporting requirements from the company anyway. So I'm not sure that there's this massive difference between...
Well, let me ask you, okay, I appreciate that answer, but then let me ask you the other, do you know any case that has explored whether these things are coextensive or not?
Of whether the...
Where the employees were held not within the Motor Carrier Act exception, but they were within the DOT regulations.
I'm not sure of any case that's gone like that. I do know that there is case law, and I'll supply your honors the name, that say that simply because the company voluntarily requires them to fill out various forms and things, that doesn't mean that they're regulated, that they've gone interstate and therefore have triggered the authority of the Department of Transportation.
Okay, well, that would be nice.
So I would like to close just with a couple of comments. I think this court is being asked to go where no court has gone before, which is to create a nationwide exemption. The several cases that have considered that have rejected that expressly. One would be the McGee case that's cited in the paper, expressly rejects that. Another case is the Solis case, expressly rejects the idea of a nationwide exemption.
Those are both district court cases.
They are, Your Honor. I realize they're not binding on this court, but their logic is...
Do you cite them in your brief? Or?
Yes, sir. They're in the paper, okay. Your Honor. They expressly reject that. Also, very interestingly, Songer itself, if you get to the actual methodology, you see that Songer didn't say, you're in a class, therefore you're exempt. Songer actually did look to see whether there's a reasonable expectation, because that's what the Department of Transportation requires. So I see my time is up, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.